Before we begin the meeting, we just would like to remind you to silence your cell phones and avoid texting during the meeting. We'll begin with a reading of the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists and a presentation of the announcements. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. It aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So this is the document of policy that binds all the different ULTs around the world, and yet each is independently devoted to the cause of theosophy. Here in Philadelphia, in keeping with the platform of work outlined in the Declaration, we have two weekly meetings. On Wednesday evenings during the winter cycle, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. We are now in the central chapters on reincarnation. And beginning this Wednesday, we are considering the perspective and explanations that reincarnation offers to us that we do not find in other approaches. And the consideration for this coming Wednesday will be character. In addition to the Wednesday evening study class, on Sunday mornings we have a more formal presentation of the philosophy in the format of a lecture, forum, or panel presentation. The umbrella theme for this month is comparative religions, spiritual growth, and there'll be more on this in a few minutes. The Sunday meeting begins at 11 and lasts at 12. In addition to these activities, there is a reference library in the front of the building. Library hours are from 5:30 to 7:30 on Wednesday evenings, and there's always a student there to help you with your individual research. Individual study is, of course, encouraged, and so on the book table, you'll find displayed original straight-line presentations of the philosophy, books, pamphlets, magazines. These are available at the cost of shipping and publication. There's no profit to be made from the sale of these books. In fact, the lodge itself is sustained entirely by contributions, voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. Each is left to decide for themselves how, when, and where they want to contribute, there being no obligation imposed or implied. Book table is open before and after meetings and during library hours. So this month, as we stated, we are having an umbrella theme of comparative religions and looking at the topic of spiritual growth. And actually, we are beginning together an experiment in presentation. Actually, the format we are going to use is a familiar one to you, the panel presentation. However, different from our previous Sunday morning classes, the entire month of Sundays for February will be in the format of a panel presentation. And in the panel presentation for each week, we'll have a theme presented, and the first speaker will give the presentation based on a look at the theme from the point of view of comparative religions, looking at what different religious and philosophical traditions connected with religions have to say about the subject, and sort of synthesize that presentation for you. Not meant to be exhaustive, but to present a general idea and perhaps encourage individual study along that line, because it is very fruitful, and it is an aspect of the objects of the theosophical movement for us to get a better understanding of comparative philosophies, religions, and of course science. The second presenter will then look at the same theme in the light of the basic fundamental teachings of the philosophy of theosophy. So together it should be quite an interesting experience, and in the panel format there will be plenty of opportunity for your contributions and questions and answers along this line. So our subject for this Sunday is responsibility begins with self-reliance, and we'll have a short presentation on that from the perspective of comparative religions.
Right, a presentation from the perspective of comparative religions and spiritual growth. What we found is that in different religions, the idea of spiritual growth and responsibility can mean different things to different people. So we'd encourage anyone who's interested in these ideas to investigate each individual religion, compare and contrast them, and it helps us to understand different people and different cultures in different ways, always with the theosophic view of trying to discern what's really the truth in any of them and what binds them together as a common human experience. In varying degrees, all kingdoms of nature have life, conscience, intelligence, or rather consciousness, intelligence, and even some kingdoms other than the human have the ability to communicate. However, only man is responsible for his own evolution. Only man is responsible for the manner in which he chooses to live and affect the world around him. The religions of the world emphasize, in one way or another, that individual responsibility has a place in faith and in practice. How that is taught in different religions varies. But one thing that's common is that individual responsibility has a place in the faith and the practice of people, of the adherents to that religion. Some of these religions, like Buddhism, Jainism, and Hinduism, regard the pilgrimage of the soul is the responsibility of each individual, the ultimate cyclic journey is guided and is a function of the individual's responsibility. Thus, each is a lamp unto himself in its truest sense, working out his own salvation. And so in these religions, there is no savior. There's no favors, and there's no one who's going to do it for you. On the other hand, in Christianity and Judaism and Islam, responsibility is given in the context of, and this is an interesting word, prevenient grace. Prevenient grace, as in salvation is there for you, is created by an outside God and available to you. You just have to do the right thing or submit to the right rules and don't do the wrong thing, and it's there for you. Which, if we think about it, that's different, we think, than taking responsibility for the evolution of soul. There's a difference between evolution of soul and releasing the lower passions and identifying oneself as one with the all, as opposed to the Western idea as, I hope I go to heaven when I die and stay there forever and be happy. There's just a difference, and we can investigate that. So then whether destiny, if we look at them collectively, whether our destiny is bound by God's predestination or by past karma or by the burden of inherited sin, world religions tend to reject the idea that the individual isn't responsible. Regardless of what is taught, generally it's accepted that the individual is responsible. Generally, the argument, such as a fatalistic attitude born of the belief that one's life is predestined, this is not the case. Rather, every person is a responsible agent who will be called to account for his own deeds in one way or another. If we are individually responsible, then we must individually maintain an attitude of self-criticism. Such is the theme of the Chinese religion of Confucianism, which makes self-rectification the basis for all ethical and political life. And now we just have a few brief quotes, one from each of the major great world religions, from Christianity regarding salvation or self-reliance on spiritual growth, which in essence it's the same thing. That's what we're talking about. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. From Islam, O ye who believe, you have charge over your own souls. From Jainism, I have heard and realized that bondage and salvation are both within yourself. From Judaism, if I am not for myself, who is for me? And when I am for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? Then from Hinduism, single is each being born, single it dies, single it enjoys the reward of its virtue, single it suffers the punishment of its own sin. And finally, from Buddhism, by self do you censor yourself. By self do you examine yourself. Self-guarded and mindful, you will live happily. Self indeed is the protector of self. Self indeed is one's refuge. Control, therefore, your own self as a merchant controls a noble steed. So there we find so many common threads in the world religions. And there are wonderful opportunities to discuss. And we'll pick up there after these ideas are presented in the light of theosophy.
In whatever endeavor or whatever attempt to grow for human beings, we acknowledge that an individual has to take responsibility for their own lives and the course they will take. Theosophy would add to this that when it comes to spiritual growth, it is absolutely necessary that the individual take responsibility. And in saying that, then theosophy is not different than any of the other presentations or themes of different religions on this subject. However, what theosophy or the basic teachings of theosophy add to it is giving us an explanation of why responsibility is necessary for spiritual growth and why that responsibility has to come from within and has to be based on self-reliance. We see from the various readings and what's been said that even though in many religions there is an emphasis on responsibility for the community, responsibility for the faith, responsibility for our family, our children, and so forth, our own behavior, the person being responsible is relying on the authority and dictates and perhaps grace of some outside power or the hope of reward for that action from some outside power. And when you think about it, there's a kind of inherent contradiction when you're trying to achieve self-reliance, but yet underneath it all, you're depending on the verification and the reward for your self-reliance from some outside source. So if there is to be a true responsibility and self-reliance, it has to come from within. When we say in the light of theosophy, we're talking about in the light of the principles of theosophy, a principle being a basis of thought and action. So you're not going to hear concise little statements of what to do, what not to do, as you might have heard in the reading. Rather, what will be laid out is the principles, the basis, and then it's up to the individual to decide what they will do with them. And that is really the basis of self-reliance. Taking an idea, checking, testing, and verifying it for oneself until it becomes a basis of self-knowledge, direct knowledge and experience, and one knows why they're responsible and knows where they want to go with their life. Nobody has to tell. So in order to gain a true basis of self-reliance, we need to begin with a truer realization of the self. And for many, in all the different religions, the notion of self is what we would call the personal self. In other words, the individual identifies with the conditions of the body, the circumstances, and the bundle of attributes, good, bad, and different, that make up its psychological nature. And in saying, I am I, they are identifying with this personality. And therefore, the notion of personality is one of uniqueness and separateness from other personalities, and very often a separateness from life itself and the source or the divine source of life. And also, our notion of self is limited because we have certain strengths, certain weaknesses in all areas of our nature. So when we say we are going to be self-reliant, well, we'll be self-reliant if we believe we have the ability. If we believe we are very skilled on the internet because we have very good mathematical and technological understanding, then we will have no problem there. But if we do not believe we're so endowed with that understanding, we'll be more likely to rely on someone else perhaps even one of our children to help us solve a problem. On the other hand, if we believe we have a pretty good insight into people and what to do in a certain circumstance, that's our strength, then we feel pretty comfortable in social situations of all kinds. If we don't have that, we might be very anxious and timid and avoid those things and have very, very little self-confidence and self-reliance. So that's the problem, in essence. Theosophy would propose to us that the source of life is one. Not one in coming from one point, but one in the sense of all. An all-encompassing basis or principle that is everywhere and everything and in everything. Now, we can call it deity or God if we're comfortable with that, as long as we don't limit it by some form or condition, because it itself is limitless. Like space is limitless, contains all things come from it, and yet it is not affected or changed by the presence of what comes and goes within it. So this concept of deity cannot be less than space. And since it is the source of all and in all beings, we might say that our higher self, our true self, our spiritual self, whatever we want to call it, is one in essence and identical with it. That the higher self in each and all is the same and one with deity. Now, based on that realization, self-reliance then is not reliance upon our personality. We can only get so far. It may begin there. But sooner or later, we have to know and sense within that we are more than this personality, that there's an aspect of our being that is universal and unchanging and enduring, like the idea of space. And upon that, we can rely, because it is the source of all, and it is within us. The second notion is that of law. Now, we may try to be reliant, self-reliant, but if we also harbor the idea that it's possible for things to occur by chance, whether in our own lives or the lives of others, or that some outside source can intervene by a miraculous intervention, then how can we possibly ever be completely self-reliant? Because we may try to be, but then always wondering, well, will something happen that will obstruct my efforts upon which I have no control? And how can I be completely self-reliant if I have to depend on something outside myself to intervene and save me? So the idea of universal law of cause and effect, action and reaction, or cycles being present in all departments of nature, including the human being, is very important. And we've heard before presented the idea of reincarnation, that of the cyclical journey of an individual soul through many different personalities, and how in some religions we have responsibility for that evolutionary progress of the soul because of that law of karma or action and reaction. What the soul establishes as a cause in one life, it will reap as an effect in another. So we might say karma is the doctrine of responsibility, because there is nothing that can happen to us in the future or is happening to us now that we have not in some way caused by our own action and inaction or inaction. So then what needs to be understood there is the relationship between ourselves and karma. Many people view karma as something outside themselves, something waiting to happen to them, and in that way apply a very fatalistic notion to karma. There is no karma, there is no action and reaction unless there is a being to make it and to receive it and feel its effects. And as self-conscious thinkers or spiritual beings, we are one with karma. We are with karma, not only in the sense of the conditions we find ourselves in as effects of karma, but there is no karma, there is no action unless we set it up. So we can be reliant on that. And the third idea is that of evolution. Evolution from the theosophical perspective includes the mental evolution of mind and includes the physical evolution of the form, but states primarily that it all begins in spirit or in self, that the original impulse and driving impulse in the lower kingdoms is within that divine essence, presence in all beings. But then when the human stage is reached and we acquire self-consciousness through the operation of mind, our further evolution depends on self-induced and self-devised efforts. There can be no further evolution unless we take responsibility for it, and we have to rely on ourselves. There are no special gifts or privileges except those upon which we've made the effort. So our evolution then is in our own hands, spiritually, mentally, and physically. So we have before us laid the foundations of how we can be self-reliant, but also we can see how the various aspects of these principles are echoed in the various traditions. Because even in the monotheistic religions which predominate the Western thought at this particular time, we find expressions of these basic ideas in a specific way. So we invite your questions and comments along this line. Yes?
Two questions. My first question is, does theosophy, by saying that the vehicle which one uses, whether we call it God or Buddha or Krishna or Christ, what we're trying to do is establish the commonality between all these things with a limitless, for lack of a better word, entity, not specific, that would all come from. And my second question is, in respect to that, when we talk about karma and the effects which we all reap from what we sow will come back to us at one point or another in some way or another, is it limited, or is it the belief that the theosophy say it comes back to us here in the earth, meaning, okay, that we reincarnate into the earth over and over again? Or is it possible that when we leave our body, being that it is a limitless universe, we can actually experience the effects of our own causes in another condition, even quite similar to this one here? In other words, if it was another dimension, such so to speak, of an earth.
Well, let's take the second question first. Where and how do we experience the effects, our karmic effects? Well, certainly, on the one hand, it's universal. Karma affects everything from the solar system down to the atom and all of life in between. So in that sense, it's universal. However, the causes that we set up come back as effects necessarily on the same plane that they were started from, whether it be the emotional plane, the physical plane, mental, etc., etc. So it's for this reason that we don't immediately necessarily experience the effect of all of our causes, because if we set up certain causes as a child, and the effects of that haven't come back as a child so we can experience it as a child, well, we wonder, in certain ways, for certain causes, what would be the benefit to the 80-year-old man to experience? Well, we can take that in a different way. Let's rephrase that. If we set up certain causes in the physical plane and die before we experience the effects of that, our understanding is that we cannot experience the effects of that until we are reborn and in a physical body. So let's leave that there. So the conditions have to be right for the effects to come back. And sometimes they're not necessarily right in the same lifetime. That's what we were trying to say. The second question had to be had to do with the word said was the vehicles, the different religions.
The vehicle that one uses
for salvation.
For attaining, awareness or become awake, more and more awake. And we may use, the manifestation of what we believe is Jesus, or the manifestation of Buddha, or the manifestation of anything, that allows us to accomplish the goal.
Right.
As long as, as long as, as we have this idea of universal oneness and universal harmony.
Okay, so really, it's not so much that theosophy looks at any particular religion as the vehicle through which one achieves a goal. Rather, each of these different religions are systems of thought that have been developed primarily by man. And actually, it's the degree to which an individual raises himself above a particular system of thought and recognizes universal ideas as the basis for thinking rather than particular thought forms. You know, a thought is a thing, and so we need to view, kind of universalize everything. That's not to say that religions aren't the right thing for the right people in any given lifetime, but it is to say that when we meet people who adhere to a particular religion and they have questions for us, as a theosophist, we would ask questions that would help them see the highest in that individual religion, the most common, most universal ideas. Yes.
When we meet people from religious walks of life who are speaking about a personal anthropomorphic God and this font of grace that can be dispensed onto a human being, if we're trying to look at that from principles, would that be a veil or one twist on the theosophical notion that as soul we partake of one source, and that with resident within the Buddhi nature of each human is a potential font of wisdom or the grace of action? Is that the way we could think about it?
We could view it that way in the sense that there tends to be this externalization of universal ideas because the Western thinker thinks he's not the universal. And therefore, that unlimited font of truth that we're talking about often is called the Holy Spirit, which is the revealer of truth to the personal, where the correspondence of that really is that theosophy would say that Holy Spirit is within and is Buddhi and is just as universal. So it's not that it's not universal, but rather that one has to view each individual as potentially and in fact universal along his path.
Well, first of all, if we're having a conversation with another individual along that line, the first thing we need to know is if the person truly believes that idea and has faith in them, let them rest in their faith. If that gives them strength and conviction to do the right thing and to take responsibility for their lives and the lives of others, that's wonderful. And if they're doing it on the basis of their highest understanding of the divine in life and that it should be expressed, they are as much and maybe even more of a true theosophist than we are, even though we may study theosophical ideas. But very often individuals in that situation come across conditions where they begin to question. And it is not because their religion has failed them. They are not acquainted with the fullness of their religion. They only know of it what they've been taught. And you have an opportunity to expose them to more of their religion than they may be aware of. But you can only do that if you've studied it and you have an understanding. And all religions have an outer or exoteric presentation, which most people are aware of, but even there, sometimes only in a limited sense, and an inner or esoteric aspect, which explains the outer form and develops and gives a philosophical basis to the outer ritual and belief. And so if one has that kind of belief, one can point them to chapter and verse in their Bible or their Holy Scripture where it gives a larger perspective of that divine source and how it is present in each and every one. So the person who believes in Jesus, you say, Jesus taught that the kingdom of heaven lies within. Follow not me, but the path I show. Greater than I to do, you can do. I go to my Father, you go unto yours. How can all these statements come from that teacher if that teacher is teaching that they are unique and the divine source of all? So one needs to work with individuals with their background from where they're coming. And that's where approaches like this, where we get to see the comparative worldview plus the light of theosophy, which really is the esoteric aspect of all these different religions presented simultaneously. Yes.
Well, how did the doctrine, and we use these words, quote, of vicarious atonement have such a hold on the public that I can be forgiven for the wrongs that I have done?
Well, to start, interestingly, that doctrine of vicarious atonement, we've learned that it is not until the 6th or 7th century of the Common Era that Christian art actually had the physical crucifixion of Christ, where it was emphasized, where you have the sculptures, etc. It wasn't for centuries after Christianity began. And it's also it's taught, especially in the Catholic Church, when they talk about the crucifixion of Christ, they drive home the blood coming out of his, you know, hands and the feet and the pictures and the sermons, and we say this with respect, but the fact is they drive home and emphasize that the physical man physically died on a cross. Prior to that, in the Western world, and even in the Eastern world back then and now, there's another method, there's another Christian means by which salvation is attained, and that's called theosis. And, there's so much to say, there's so much to be read about that, but we would just in a nutshell say that this idea of theosis, which is a Christian path to salvation, other than through Jesus Christ dying on a cross, is the Western answer to Raja Yoga. And if anyone is interested in that, there's a lot that's written on theosis. And some people who write on theosis do so very carefully because they don't want to be ostracized by the Christian community. But in fact, theosis in and of itself does not require the Christian to believe that their only means of salvation is through Christ dying on the cross. So the question was,
Vicarious.
So then back to this idea of vicarious atonement. So it is there. The teaching is there among Christian sects that vicarious atonement is not required. However, in the West, among Protestant sects and the Catholic Church, pretty much the teaching has been within the Western Christian system of thought that vicarious atonement is required. In other words, Jesus died for the sins of man, and only through him is any individual saved. It's a great marketing technique for the Christian world.
So when you plant a seed, the fruit of that seed depends on the conditions of the soil you plant it in. If you teach vicarious atonement, as is taught in certain religious traditions, and you plant the seed that someone else suffered and died for you, if that seed is implanted in a gentle heart, that would be a virtue and an asset to any religion because of their inherent character of compassion for their fellow human beings. That person's going to receive that and think, if this person did this for me, then I want to do that for others. I want to emulate. you take that same seed and you plant that in the heart of one who is primarily self-centered and selfish, then that one believes that they can do that whatever they want, and all they have to do is say, I believe, and they will be forgiven for all their sins and be welcomed into eternal life. So the doctrine of vicarious atonement, like any other idea, can be used for good or evil. Now, does it have a real basis? Well, the esoteric aspect of Christianity in the early centuries of its formation, before the time spoken of, was Gnosticism, or the Gnosis. And many of the church fathers were students of the Gnosis, Christian Gnosis, and taught it, and there was a big conflict. Finally, the Gnosis aspect of Christianity won out, but lost out. But in that teaching, the Christ principle was not a human being, rather than the divine principle in every being, the Christos principle, or the Buddhi principle, or the Krishna principle, the highest divine spark in each being, that suffers by its contact with matter. But unless the spiritual evolves in and blends with the lower, there can be no salvation, no lifting up for the lower intelligence and consciousness. So in a sense, the higher sacrifices itself on the cross of matter for the salvation of all. And this is what we all do as reincarnating beings that live from life to life. We incarnate not only for the further evolution of our souls, but by contacting life and using a form and receiving the effects of causes previously set up. Yes, we suffer. Yes, we are limited by the conditions of life, but it is only through that contact that others can be lifted up and benefit. So that is the philosophical basis behind that teaching of vicarious atonement, that something else or someone else can save us, can lift us up. Yes?
There's a part of me that believes that there is some truth to kind of predetermined destinies and things like that. And, you know, I don't know, it's like, I'm learning to start to trust my instincts. I know there's something to it now, and there's been a lot of wise people, you know, that have read their books and have some belief in this as well. And I don't know if you guys have any thoughts as to how I can kind of integrate this into my experience. But you know, for example, one of the things I thought about is, you know, maybe our karma creates predetermined life streams. Or other people believe that when you enter into a life stream, you kind of pick the blueprint for the lessons you want to learn. I'm not sure. I just that, you know, right now I'm wrestling with, do I have this complete ability to, and responsibility to determine my own life at this point, or has it already been determined by me before I came into this life stream?
Well, we think definitely the theosophical answer to that is within the question, and from the way the question was posed, the answer is yes. In the sense that, you know, this idea of predestiny, if the individual thinks that there's only one life and that God has laid out all of these things that are to be experienced, certainly that idea of predestination is hardly theosophical. However, if the individual accepts the fact of multiple lives and everything that is going on in this life and that will happen in this life is a function of the conditions that have been set up by thoughts and actions in previous lives, then in that sense, there is a predestiny in the sense that the causes are set up. You know, if I put my hand in the flame, I am predestined to get blisters under law. Now, there are some born into certain conditions where it seems where they really, gosh, really there is little control. And we could say of the you know, in certain places in India where the children are bound to fulfill the debts of their father, nevertheless, that child comes into an incarnation, and that is the effect of whatever went on in previous lives. But then there are those who are born into a free society with a relatively healthy body and a good mind and karmic opportunities for education and direction. Well, it seems that person is much more free, but that freedom is there because of the basis for action and thought that he had in previous lives. So in both situations, theosophy gives a resounding yes to everything is the result of taking personal responsibility or the result of not taking personal responsibility in previous lives. And it's the effect. So in both cases, yeah, in a way there's predestination, but it's set up by the individual, by his own karma, by his own thoughts and actions.
So to state that response in a different way, there are three aspects to the operation of karma. There are the causes that we are setting up that we will reap in the future. There are the effects of previous causes that we are receiving now that have been set up in the past. And so this seems to be the predestination experience, that we don't understand the causes that were set up, we just know the effects that we're having. And the third aspect is that there is much of karma or effects that we cannot yet experience because the conditions are not present. Now, in the Bible, for hundreds of years before Jesus, there was a tremendous philosophical debate among the Jews that was based on this statement from the Old Testament, that the sins of the father will be passed down to the sons for seven generations. And because of that, many individuals said, I am not responsible. It's because what my father and grandfather and did. If I'm doing this, it's because of what they did, and I'm inheriting their sins. And the prophets went around rallying against this idea, and they said, Jeremiah was very vocal about it. He said, don't ever teach this. It is absolutely not part of Judaism. So that comes Jesus, who's teaching certain things, and his disciples come up to him and they say, well, what of this man who's born blind? Is he suffering because of something he did? How can he be suffering for something he did if he was born blind? Or is it the responsibility of his parents, his father? You know, in other words, in the context of inheriting, his blindness is inheritance for the sins of his fathers. And Jesus answers the question this way. It is for the manifestation of the glory of God. For most of us, we stop at that point without reading what follows. And it's very important. He picks up some dust from the ground. He spits in it to create a little paste, puts the paste on the individual's eyes, and the individual can now see. Now, that's usually interpreted as the miraculous powers of Jesus or the divine. But what it's saying to us is that yes, we are responsible for the conditions we come into, but not all our suffering is punishment. Some of it is an opportunity to show the power of spirit and soul within, to be an example, a light unto others. And many individuals who are very far along in their development, tremendous character, through their own previous efforts and choices, incarnate into conditions which are very difficult. but they do so willingly in order to be a benefit to others, to be a model, we might say, of the glory of the divine. And in a sense, that's what the great saviors of the world have done for us. They find themselves persecuted, crucified, condemned. Yes, it's the result of their action, but they're not there out of punishment. They're there to be examples of the glory of what it really means to be a perfected human being. Yes?
Well, we also have humans, one of the differences between us and the lower kingdoms is that we have the power through choice. So no matter what situations we have set up in the past, when they come to us, we can choose a higher road or a lower road, which will in turn affect future karma as well. So even if it seems as though it's predestined, our response to it is not predestined.
So the idea being that we may not know where the original cause was set up, but what is not predestined is the way we will choose. Now, in some religious traditions, there is taught the idea that, yes, our choice is predestined. Even in science, they'll say we do not have free will and choice, that it's predestined. And what it means there is that the external and internal influences can be so great that for any one individual, they may be overwhelmed by it and not really have free choice because they are imprisoned. They are influenced. They are so weakened that they cannot help but make a certain choice. But that weakened condition of will, that powerful condition of external circumstances that press upon us, is not fate. It is the result of causes we set up. But even the individual in that position, if they can for a moment stop identifying with what they perceive to be their small puny self in the context of everything that's closing in around them, and turn within and realize that they have within them the light of the divine, that they are one in essence with it, that nothing can destroy them, their self. No power on earth, no fire, no water can corrupt it, no wind can dry it away, as Krishna says. Then from the basis of that self-reliance, they are free to choose how they respond. They may not be able to overcome the wave that's coming at them, but they are free in their own mind and heart to choose their attitude towards it. And from that, they set up new conditions for the future. Yes.
This week, I happened to hear someone say that we all feel pain. We all suffer from pain, but not all have to suffer misery. Mm-hmm. And I thought that short little statement encapsulated a lot of what you're saying.
Thank you. Yes.
I think this matter of free choice and free will is really the most important thing. And I've been looking back at my life at times and looked at some choices I have made in the past where I was agonizing over something very important and I ended up with something that I thought was the best choice at that time. And as I look back, I see the broader picture and I see that there were other choices. I just didn't see them at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, our will may be free and our choices may be free, but they're not, but they are also sometimes blind. But that's one of the benefits of having free will and choice. If you make mistake, you ultimately learn from them. It's as important to know what not to do the next time as it is to know what we should do. Yes.
I just wanted to throw in, interesting that this was said because at the time when the Declaration and the Constitution were written, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, the word happy was more to be able to reap the effects that I sow. whether they're wealth or poverty, I choose my destination or destiny. But that word has really changed in those 200 years. But happy back then really meant take control of the king away, let me do it for better or worse. Interesting. Yes. Oh, yes.
In Buddhism, they sometimes say, well, if something really positive happens, they'll say, well, that's great, but just wait. And if something, something really negative, that we'll say, oh my God, I'm so happy. But then the Buddhist philosophy is almost that, just wait. Because you never know what the real ramifications are until much later. But that always made me feel kind of, I never could connect to Buddhism because it wasn't optimistic enough. It was like, well, something great is going to happen, but who knows what the real result will be. So you could never feel ever really good about anything. So can you address that? I mean, if you're saying, everything is the result of something positive happens, it's sort of, in Buddhism, it's not necessarily that way.
Well, that's the fun of theosophy. I mean, it's universal. That's a defeatist way to look at it. And, some people will, no matter where, it's always going to just wait. It's going to be worse than you'd ever thought it would have been. But gee whiz, if we know that the doctrines of hope and responsibility are always there for us, and we operate within the law, we can know that no matter what comes our way, we have, as students of this philosophy, if we accept the fact that we always have the capacity and the power to take what comes our way and make the best of it, it's a reason to have hope.
We wanted to mention about Buddhism. We have to be very careful when we say Buddhism says, as any religion says, because the Buddha, the Buddhism of the Buddha is not the Buddhism of today. There are hundreds of sects of Buddhism, and many of them originate from the Southern or Hinayana school, and some of them in certain areas of the world originate from the Mahayana schools. And the two distinctions there are in the Southern schools, of which you're quoting, the teaching is that there is no permanent soul that reincarnates from life to life. There is a divine permanent essence, but what reincarnates are the tendencies of the personality. There is no enduring individual existence. And that's a critical difference between that philosophy of Buddhism and the Mahayana schools, which definitively teaches a presence of a reincarnating ego. Now, here's the thing. If you realize that if it's good now, just wait, it's going to be bad. And you realize it may be bad now, but just wait, it's going to get better. The ultimate lesson of that is you're going to be there whether it's good or bad. Conditions come and go, but you're still going to be there. That's the lesson. That's what you want to learn. You want to see that. What could be more ignorant for us? What could produce more ignorance that we just experience one and never get the other? That's why this idea of eternal salvation and endless heaven or hell is so unjust and so rubbing against something in us that doesn't seem to be right. Because we know we want to grow. We want to learn from experience. We want to do things. We will rebel if somebody tries to limit what we believe we have the ability to do or our power to choose. We fight for that freedom, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness through what we want to do. So the idea that we can't experience pleasure or pain in the future, we just have to be stuck in some eternal condition fixed for us, doesn't sit right for the soul. Well, we did want to...
We have one last question in the back.
Okay.
Was there a question? Yes.
We were just thinking of the idea that the theosophy teaches that we should not be attached to either happiness or also the experiences.
That's right. So we not only survive, but because we endure that, there's no sense being attached to those limited conditions, but rather learn from them.
We'd like to just finish this up with a statement from Confucianism. The ancients, and this is back in Confucius's day, he was talking about the ancients. The ancients who wished to manifest their clear character to the world would first bring order to their states. Those who wished to bring order to their states would first regulate their families. Those who wished to regulate their families would first cultivate their personal lives. Those who wished to cultivate their personal lives would first rectify their minds. Those who wished to rectify their minds would first make their wills sincere. Those who wished to make their wills sincere would first extend their knowledge. The extension of knowledge consists in the investigation of things. When things are investigated, knowledge is extended. When knowledge is extended, the will becomes sincere. When the will becomes sincere, mind is rectified. When mind is rectified, the personal life is cultivated. When the personal life is cultivated, the family will be regulated. When the family is regulated, the state will be in order. When the state is in order, there will be grace, peace throughout the world. From the Son of Heaven down to the common people, all must regard cultivation of the personal life as the root or foundation. There is never a case when the root is in disorder and yet the branches are in order. Our meeting's adjourned.
Very good.
That's neat.
Very good. That's
good. Yeah.
That's
good. Kush made it easy for us, didn't he?
Huh?
Kush made it easy for me, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, yeah.
It was all right there.
Right. Could you get me a copy of that? Whenever you have some.
Sure.
That list? The one that that's it.
Top two paragraphs.
That's really good. That's really good.
Oh, yeah. Okay.